And now for reading and writing and radio.
Marcy listened to Thad's progress. A cracking twig, a stumbled footfall, a small splash of water, a vexed mutter. She heard the dock creak. Nearby, she heard the rhythmic squeak and dip of the oars of some night rower. Then there was a sharp exclamation, the clatter of the bucket on the dock, followed by a splat, and Thad's feet pounding back up the path.
The collector and author of those sounds was Jacqueline Jackson, but it could be you. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University. Here to begin today's program is Ken Nost.
Jackie, are we going to talk about what my ears hear or about what my ears hear?
I once heard a four-year-old boy come rushing in to tell his mother some exciting event that he had just been a part of, and his little four-year-old friend was with him. And Chad began telling what he had heard. And his friend interrupted him after he'd given a sentence or two, and he said, "You didn't hear that," and began to give his version of what he had heard. Whereupon Chad interrupted the friend and said to him indignantly, "Your ears can't hear what my ears hear." And the grown-ups that were around all looked at each other, and we began to discuss this little phrase, this thing that Chad had said, and we realized that he was very correct, that both he and his friend had heard the same things, but that Chad's ears had heard all by themselves, that the friend's ears had not heard what Chad's ears heard, that only Chad's ears could hear what Chad's ears heard.
Even though the ears were really the same as far as
the same mechanism.
Yeah.
And what Chad was saying unconsciously was that what comes into him through his ears gets sent up to his brain in a different way than the things that come into his friend's ears, so that both of them could be hearing something going on, and they would get quite a different interpretation of it, or maybe just a slightly different interpretation of it. But that Chad did have his own unique way of interpreting and of hearing the things that came into his own ears. Well, this seems to me to be a valuable thing for people to recognize, and especially people that want to do some writing, that we are all unique in this way. It's true of our eyes, too, and our other senses, but especially with our ears.
In other words, some people really hear more than others because their brain says they heard it, whereas other people don't remember it at all.
Sound is going on around us all the time, and a lot of that sound we don't hear. We're selective listeners. Now, I think you have to be a selective listener to a certain extent because we're so bombarded by sound that we have to sort it out and put it in order. I read a book when I was in high school where the hero of the story had been deaf since a childhood accident. And he has another accident which restores his hearing. And when he comes to in the hospital, he spends a day or two of considerable confusion because of how noisy everything is. He's hearing everything until he begins to sort out the noises, what he's going to listen to, what he doesn't have to listen to, and his brain makes that sort of adjustment.
Must have been actually frightening for a while for him.
I should imagine that it would be, and in any new situation where we aren't used to screening things through our brains, that this would be the case. Not necessarily frightening. We might come on something with delight to be hearing sounds that we haven't heard before. I was standing on a step in a town, and a stranger was standing beside me, and the traffic noises were going by, and I said out loud, more to myself than to him, "There's a mourning dove." And he looked at me very sharply, and he said, "Did you hear that too?" And it turned out that we both knew mourning doves, and that somehow through the noise of that town, we had heard that mourning dove giving his mournful yodum, da, da, da.
And you both had your expanded ears on, too.
Yes, we were tuned in to that sort of thing. And this is what I mean about selective listening being important. We need to tune in to certain sorts of things. But on the other hand, we should be aware of how many things that we're tuning out.
Well, how does one go about trying to learn how to do this, to expand our hearing? How can we learn this? We can't just push a button and say, now we'll hear more than we did before.
Well, there's lots of ways that we could expand listening. And I think that the first way is just to recognize that we have tuned a lot of things out, that there's a lot of hearing that we could be doing of things that we've gotten used to. This might be a good time to read this passage where a boy is deliberately listening. He has a blind friend, and he is trying to see what it's like to be blind. Here it is right here.
"Now I'll lie here and listen to what Susan heard," he thought, and at once realized how much wind there was and how big, telltale, and friendly. It bumped into and passed around sheds. It crossed the gravel, bowling, protesting dead leaves before it. The birds were trying to sing because it was March, but the song was interrupted, jerked out of their throats as they were tossed off the branches by the wind, and flew with an extra flutter that reminded Tolly of rowing in rough water. He heard the branches of two trees that leaned against each other squeaking and groaning like an overloaded cart. He heard the church clock strike one, and Bogus slipped past on his bicycle almost as quietly as an owl. The sound was so slight, he opened his eyes to see if he had guessed right.
This, of course, is a good thing to do, to shut your eyes, to listen in different sorts of situations, as Tolly does in this passage from The Treasure of Greenough. Elspeth, in nursery school, had a teacher who would expand their ears by making noises for them to hear and to identify. The children would all shut their eyes, and she would drop objects on the floor. She'd drop a pencil, and they'd have to identify it, and drop a block, and there was quite a different sound between a wooden pencil and a wooden block. And those little kids got so they could tell the difference between a penny and a nickel and a dime and a quarter when it was dropped, in the very delicate nuances of sound.
The owl in this Dr. Doolittle story has pretty good ears, too, Jackie. While they were standing around, wondering what they should do, the owl Tutu suddenly said, "Shh, listen, I do believe there's someone in there." Well, they all kept still a moment. Then the doctor said, "You must be mistaken, Tutu. I don't hear anything." "I'm sure of it," said the owl. "Shh, there it is again. Don't you hear that?" "No, I do not," said the doctor. "What kind of a sound is it?" "I hear the noise," said the owl, "of someone putting his hand in his pocket." "But that makes hardly any sound at all," said the doctor. "You couldn't hear that out here." "Oh, pardon me, but I can," said Tutu. "I tell you, there's someone on the other side of that door putting his hand in his pocket. Almost everything makes some noise, if your ears are only sharp enough to catch it. Bats can hear a mole walking in his tunnel under the earth, and they think they're good hearers. But we owls can tell you, using only one ear, the color of a kitten from the way it winks in the dark." "Well, well," said the doctor, "you surprise me. That's quite interesting. Listen again and tell me what he's doing now." "Shh, make that fidgety pig keep still. Now, all hold your breath for a moment so that I can listen well. This is very difficult, what I'm doing now, and that beastly door is so thick." "Shh, everybody quite still. Shut your eyes and don't breathe." And Tutu leaned down and listened again very hard and long. At last,
He looked up into the doctor's face and said, "The man in there is unhappy. He weeps. He has taken care not to blubber or sniffle, lest we should find out that he's crying. But I heard, quite distinctly, the sound of a tear falling on his sleeve."
"Well, how do you know it wasn't a drop of water falling off the ceiling on him?" asked Gub Gub.
"Ah, such ignorance," sniffed Tuk Tuk. "A drop of water falling off the ceiling would have made 10 times as much noise."
"Well," said the doctor, "if the poor fellow's unhappy, we've got to get in and see what's the matter with him. Find me an axe, and I'll chop the door down."
Well, Tutu probably has much more finely developed ears than we do, but we can develop our hearing, which will make life richer for us, but it will also make us better writers to be able to hear these things.
Yeah, when we expand our hearing, say we can do this, even though we can't hear a teardrop on a sleeve, what do we write about? How do we write about it?
Well, there's various ways that we could use our expanded ears and our clearer hearing in our writing. A good way to begin would be just making lists, say, of sounds that you like or the sounds that you don't like. I made my own list, which would include the wind rattling a dry cornfield. And, of course, water sounds. I love the sound of water in all its forms.
Rain, I think most of us do, the water.
There is something, you know, very fulfilling about water sounds. In the book, The Animal Family, there's a little sentence about water sounds. "He listened for a long time. A mermaid is singing. The song ended on a low, long, low note, and then everything was silent except the sea, whose shallow silver waves made a little hushing sound and were silent for an instant and then said, hush, again."
Mm-hmm. I think the sounds we like depend so much on our background, both on our age and where we're from. The cornfield, I've never heard a cornfield, but you have, you see.
Yes. Most of us have heard water in some form. The Wind in the Willows is a book that has many wonderful descriptions of all the senses in it. Almost at random, you can find these sorts of things. And in my own book, The Ghost Boat, there's a description of Marcy listening to her brother go down to the lake at night to dump a bucket full of sunfish. Marcy listened to Thad's progress. A cracking twig, a stumbled footfall, a small splash of water, a vexed mutter. She heard the dock creak, and then the large splash that meant Phil and his brothers were safely back in the briny deep. Nearby, she heard the rhythmic squeak and dip of the oars of some night rower. Then there was a sharp exclamation, the clatter of the bucket on the dock, followed by a splat, and Thad's feet pounding back up the path.
You see, the way we write and the words we use can get across these things. In fact, I noticed in there, you yourself used, at one point, splash, splash, and splat. Three different things, three different sounds.
Three different nuances of sound, mm-hmm. Yes. And in our writing, we could investigate these differences of sound. Passage on Tali of the wind blowing. The wind blows in a million different ways, and we could describe its blustering, its fretfulness. The line in the Robert Frost poem that says, "The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake." That sweep of easy wind is a very different sort of sound from a storm wind or from a summer zephyr, a little ruffling breeze. And so we could take sounds and try to describe the different nuances of wind, the different nuances of water, the different nuances of city noise or of school noise. How is the noise of your classroom, say, different from the noise of the one down the hall? What is the character of your noise? A noise I find that's extremely interesting is a dog who is asleep and having dreams. He makes a succession of little squeaks and shivers and noises, whimpers. You wonder what he's dreaming about and whether to disturb him. You could list the noises that you don't like. A mosquito when you're in bed.
This means something. It means you're going to get bitten.
Yes, but it's a very unpleasant noise. I guess everybody winces at chalk on a blackboard in a certain way, or somebody's fingernail run down a car finish.
Makes you shiver to think of it.
These are all sounds that can be used in writing. We can make poems out of these bits of sounds or the differences of sounds. And then we could try putting these sounds into words, seeing how well we could describe a sound through words. You've got a couple of poems there that I brought that are definitely trying to imitate sounds in the words of the poem.
This one has to do with rhythm, in a sense. It's called Windy Nights. Whenever the moon and stars are set, whenever the wind is high, all night long in the dark and wet, a man goes riding by. Late in the night when the fires are out, why does he gallop and gallop about? Whenever the trees are crying aloud and ships are tossed at sea, by on the highway low and loud, by at the gallop goes he. By at the gallop he goes, and then by he comes back at the gallop again, and you're galloping right along with him.
And then there's another little poem there that it's trying to imitate the sound of a watch. It's called The Watch.
I wakened on my hot, hard bed. Upon the pillow lay my head. Beneath the pillow, I could hear my little watch was ticking clear. I thought the throbbing of it went like my continual discontent. I thought it said, in every tick, I am so sick, so sick, so sick. Oh, death, come quick, come quick, come quick, come quick, come quick, come quick, come quick.
In our writing, we can not only describe how a word feels, as in that galloping poem where the rhythm of it is giving you the sound of galloping, but the little watch poem illustrates two ways. There is both the rhythm of the watch, the death come quick, come quick, come quick, is like the tick-tock of a watch, but also those little short clipped words are imitating the short clipped sound of a watch, so that if we want to write something that is smooth, then we would use smooth and slidey and sinuous sounding words to give a smooth feeling, in the same way that we would use death come quick, come quick, come quick to give the sharp tick, tick, tick of a watch. There's a word for these sounds. They're called onomatopoetic, words that sound like they're supposed to. The words that you mentioned of my splash and splat and splatter, all those watery sounds are meant to imitate the actual sound of the water. And we can try how well can we imitate sound with words. And you can make up words, too. You don't have to be bound by the words that have already been used. If you have a sound that you can't describe, give the word that you can make up that best describes it to somebody else.
A word like bong, which was made up by somebody in the past.
Yes, bong, of course, is imitating a gong. Then, using our ears, there's another whole area of writing, which is to write anecdotes and stories that center around sound. So I would encourage all writers to try writing about sounds, because I can't hear what your ears hear. None of us can hear what your ears hear, and you are the only one that can tell us. And if you can put down what your ears hear in a way that will help us to hear, then we're going to be the richer, because we not only have our own consciousness of what we hear, but it's been added on to by what you hear. And perhaps we can begin to hear what you hear and the way that you hear it by having you tell us about it.
Let's hope they will, Jackie.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708. Thank you.